This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
deepfake plot hooks.
People's Park.
Big lugs.
And Arabic geomancy.
Big news from Mission Control. If you missed out the first time, don't panic. The wait is over. The Catstronauts board game is finally back in stock at Atlas Games.
That's right. Catstronauts sold out almost immediately on release, but the reprint has officially landed. Now you can finally bring the kitty crew home to your tabletop.
And just in time, too, because things are getting interesting on the International Space Station.
Giant laser pointers in space and a live stream of nose boops? What's not to like? Let's check out how the Catstronauts are doing up there.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Careful, Waffles. If the other Catstronauts catch you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, it's back to litter box duty for you.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady, Pom Pom is swatting at fasteners like feather toys, and Major Meowser is... napping on the instructions.
Teamwork at its finest. You can lead this kitty crew yourself in the official Catstronauts board game.
It's a cooperative challenge featuring pawsome art by the comics creator Drew Brockington, and it's perfect for gamers of all ages.
But remember, the first printing disappeared at light speed. Don't let this reprint of Catstronauts slip through your claws.
Secure your copy today at atlas-games.com/catstronauts. That's atlas-games.com/catstronauts. The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive welcome us once more into the gaming hut, as we can see on this high-definition video of the gaming hut. There we are, all playing the game, talking amongst ourselves, and... saying horrendous things that we would never, ever say in public that may be an average game night, or it might be a deep fake, Robin. We can't tell, because beloved Patreon backer Ben Brigoff points out that deep fakes have gotten good enough to fabricate phone calls and even Zoom meetings, a particular concern for companies which are sometimes asking cybersecurity firms to create deep fakes of their CEOs to understand how good they can be and to know what to look out for. What gaming plot hooks leap to mind besides, I assume, the Max Headroom CEO going amok and, you know, raising everyone's salary or something?
Right. In an upcoming project in Casilda's Song, in the This Is Normal Now book, there is a scenario all about deepfakes. And the premise there is that the deepfakes that start to appear and are uploaded to the internet, as you sort of hinted at in your preamble, are you and your other player characters doing things and performing rants, but you weren't there. You didn't have anything to do with this. You didn't post these things. You didn't say those things. They were at recognizable locations in the city you live in, and you just don't know what's happening, but it doesn't seem good. And so you have to go and investigate that. And I think that is the easiest layup for a deepfake scenario.
That obviously you can take that same scenario, strip out the Yellow King and add a mean teen, and it's a bubble gumshoe scenario, because who is going to be deepfaked harder than the somewhat unpopular girl in high school? And she will come to the sleuths and hope for satisfaction, or God forbid the sleuths themselves are being deepfaked by someone that they've thwarted earlier. It's a natural scenario. It's going to be a classic in the future. This is going to be the, you know, your uncle dies and leaves you a haunted house level of standard opener, I think, in the coming decade.
Yes, your uncle dies and leaves you his will, which he recorded sitting in the front seat of his Volkswagen.
Right.
And it's not real. He doesn't even own that place. It's a trap.
Right.
Yeah.
It wasn't your uncle. You don't even have an uncle.
Yeah, I didn't think I had an uncle.
Right.
And so I think there's some things to keep in mind, whatever the scenario is. And one is that in a mystery, this has to be still non-baffling to the skilled investigators who are the player characters, so that their computer skills are always good enough to identify a deep fake. They can find the tells, they can run the scans, and they can also tell when a deep fake is not the product of known computer science, but instead is something eerie or weird. And in fact, that is one of the clues in the scenario I mentioned, is that you discover that it's not just a computer thing, that they're on computers, they're recorded, they're digital, but it's not known deep fake technology. And that's how you know to go and look for the weirdness instead of the tween who would be the villain in Bubblegum Shoe. You can also, I think, use this interestingly in backgrounds to your scenarios, because, for example, in The Esoterist, the advent of deepfakes has made the Ordo Veritatis's veil-out job easier than it's ever been.
Yes,
and you can just leave up the video of the dread Outer Dark entity prowling through the parking lot, ripping the tops off of cars. And you can just say, oh, yeah, we don't have to cover this up anymore at all. We just say it's clearly a fake.
Yeah, it's just AI.
Yeah. And then you run it through a couple of filters and add a couple of obvious digital artifacts, indications that make it seem like AI. And there you go. You can report back to head office or back to your different ordinary lives. And your job is done. Veilouts have never been easier.
And again, it's not just a veilout, which would also work for Delta Green games. It can be a story hook. Like, this is showing up on the internet. There's this horrible tentacled being that is sloshing around through the park. There are dogs missing in the park. There's always dogs missing in the park. Is it a deep fake? Is it kids messing around with AI? Is it an entity that you need to stop? And so you need to sort of pursue both a digital inquisition, and then also go check out the park and see, are there going to be kids shooting B-roll for their deepfake video, or is it going to be, you know, Schloopy Monster? And in an Esoterra game, did making cool deepfake AI of a Schloopy Monster thin out the veil because people are believing that the park is haunted, and now suddenly that made the park be haunted? And so you have to maybe not stop a Schloopy AI monster, but some other kind of horrible brain rot creature from the Outer Dark. And that, again, it can become, and I predict will become, a standard opener in these sorts of modern occult investigation games, where it's, is it deepfake or is it real? The only way to go is to show up and smell like prey.
The CEO element is one in which you can realize that your boss who shows up on Zoom meetings seems a little off, seems weird. Is this a fake boss? What's up with that? And you can investigate. And one thing you could discover is, oh, your boss has become a vampire and he can't show up on camera anymore, but he still wants to attend Zoom meetings. So he needed to create a deep fake avatar, which is actually following his instructions and doing what he wants to do, but he can still show up on Zoom meetings. And so the option of someone impersonating themselves in order to disguise what's really going on with them, or it could just be that there's all sorts of things that someone could deep fake themselves to hide, turning into a robot, they're becoming a deep one. That makes it a double deep fake, of course.
Yes.
Or could in fact be that, you know, someone has taken them and is impersonating them. And we've been this far into the segment before we've said tulpa. So we'll have to see tulpas that indeed a deep fake tulpas may be attempting to take over people's identities or just to assert digital identities that eventually become real. So perhaps that CEO isn't a flesh and blood person at all, but it's some sort of initially perhaps a digital being who then is looking to acquire some flesh to walk around in. And that can cause all sorts of trouble that you might well want to prevent.
I just want to sidebar it and say, I literally was having a conversation yesterday with one of my friends who strongly suspects that two of the people who are sending him email at his job and are supposedly like the chief of staff at the company, who he's never met, are AI. So this is not necessarily just a game scenario that we're all imagining. This stuff is going to happen. Moving back into the supernatural universe, we have the notion of what is better image magic. You know, who needs to make a wax puppet and put things in it when you can build a deepfake of the guy that you want to torture and show him being tortured on your magically consecrated server. And then that gets out. First of all, that creates a, someone is making image magic of our CEO, and he's being tortured in it. And he's also suffering heart attacks, and we need him to stay our boss, figure out what's going on, find the digital sorcerer who's doing this stuff. But also, you get the notion of once the electronic version becomes self-aware, then you do have a digital tulpa, and it can sort of translate itself because the internet is its native world. There's a place where no one's computer skills can be strong enough to stop it because it lives in the computer. You can't hunt it down there. It'll bop into, you know, the About Us page on the website or, you know, a LinkedIn profile. No one goes to LinkedIn. You know, that's like Chinatown for digital investigators. And so
apparently all sorts of people still go to LinkedIn, which is the weirdest thing we're going to tell you in this whole entire segment.
And so the, you have to figure out a meat space way to stop the deepfaker, which again is track them down using the ordinary ways that you would track down someone committing forgery, fraud, embezzlement, and then show up at their house and shoot them or beat them up in a nicer game, a bubblegum shoot type game. And that is, you know, something to always keep in mind, that the computer skills, the elite computer skills of our heroes don't necessarily have to be there outside the techno thriller genre, that it can be a straight up, well, they're great on the computer, but they're terrible at OPSEC, so we are still going to be able to find them.
Right. And helping a sapient computer program escape is a longstanding cyberpunk staple, along with kill a sapient digital individual. In the first instance, you could have had someone who was created in order to be tortured by some terrible group of people, perhaps just, you know, the mob, someone engaged in extortion. But they achieve sapience and an ability to manipulate the world, whether that's a Final Destination style ability to create Rube Goldberg devices, or again, if you inhabit one of those dog robots, or you use a neural interface to get a meat body, and they could be going on the killing rampage in order to find those people. That's one of those scenarios where once you find out what the creature is doing to kill people, you go, oh, well, don't let me stand in your way.
Right,
but
yeah,
there is undoubtedly some other collateral damage or harm, or they've become, you know, utterly ruthless and have decided to, you know, harm innocent people associated with the people who harmed them. And you still, you know, have reason to want to find them and shut them down.
I mean, they may be understandable, but they're still a digital CEO. So they may not have been built with a conscience to start with. The other thing I guess we can talk about is that you can sort of, like many things, back space it into magic, because anything you can do with a deepfake story, you can do with an illusion story in F20. And so all of these ideas can easily be translated back to, oh, there's an illusion of the prince walking around giving weird orders about lowering the gates and not stopping the orcs. What's that about? And, you know, just take those same stories, translate them into worlds of magic. Maybe, like in some F20s, all the good illusionists are gnomes. So you just have to sort of look around and see who's not, you know, at your eye level. And that's probably the bad guy. But maybe there's, you know, more to it. And the gnome is being threatened. You know, it's like, they're keeping my pod hostage in our burrow. You have to help me. I made the prince obviously bad so as to draw your attention to this ring of Thieves Guild guys or whoever it is, the orcs.
Right. So essentially, this is the fantasy world version of sending an illusion of you to a Zoom meeting. You're the guy in the tavern who told you where the dungeon was an illusion.
Right.
When you get to the dungeon, it's an illusion too, except there's some terrible trap waiting for you. And when illusions are laying terrible traps for us, it's time for us to flee into some other segment or hut.
I want high fantasy investigative adventure.
But Ken, there's only one of you.
I got you there. You are a GM, Robin.
You do have me there.
And a GM and a player is all you need for Paragon Blade, the gumshoe one-to-one game of swords and spells.
In the Paragon Blade from fantasy master Gareth Ryder Hanrahan, you play a hero in a fantastical land, still scarred by the evil of the fallen hellbound empire.
Mystery and magic collide in tales of conspiratorial wizards, monstrous foes, and arcane intrigue.
Gather your wits, your allies, and your blade.
Three advantages see you through the perils that await.
A trusty companion, a wise mentor, a stalwart servant, or cryptic ally.
A relic from the dark days of old, a treacherous artifact of terrible power.
And most of all, you're a hero of great skill and insight. You'll read the riddle of this broken world and battle evil in all its many forms.
Aragon Blade includes all the rules you need for an intense head-to-head experience in the fantasy vein.
Plus, detailed guidance on building your own heroes and quests.
Fits superbly with virtual tabletops.
Comes with three scenarios with the heroes designed to plumb their mysteries.
Barbarian hero Khan the Unslain must race against time to seek a cure for a demonic curse in Heart of the Beast.
Aletheia the Scholar must conceal her sorcerer's powers from her father the Magistrate while helping him investigate the Isle of Death.
Puck the Thief must steal the Jar of Doom before anyone else opens it.
Paragon Blade, now available at the Palgrain Web Store.
Or at a discerning game retailer near you.
The plotting of the plotter pens, the timer that whirls and whirls as we save a giant CAD file, tell us that we're once more in the Architecture Hut. And this time around, estimable backer Alexander Arabalo wants us to talk about the occult or supernatural significance of People's Park in Berkeley, California, called by some of its founders a site of the unhoused, the deranged, and the forlorn. So what causes it to have such an effect on people? Ken, take us to People's Park in Berkeley.
Yeah, I mean, if you're asking what makes people crazy, and the answer is it's in Berkeley, California, the answer may be right in front of your nose. But let's dig deeper to this 2.8-acre block, known on maps as Block 1875, between Haste Street and Dwight Way, and it's bounded on the east by Bowditch Street. And again, we're in Berkeley, so let's begin with the land acknowledgement. It began as the ground of the Hwichin Ohlone people, so we don't know any specific thing about that area because the Spanish showed up in 1776 and sort of cleared everybody out. The whole area was under a single ranch. All of Berkeley and much of Oakland and Palo Alto was under the San Antonio Ranch. And then the gold rush happened and Americans showed up and said, "You're not using all that ranch, are you, fella?" And the guy said, and they subdivided his ranch is the point. They founded the University of California there in 1868. Residences grew up around the university, and then they had to build a train line between the university and the actual town, which was down closer to the coast at that time. And so the stretch south of campus, which is Block 1875, is being built up. The first Congregational Church shows up in Block 1875. That's in 1874. It's the first church in Berkeley, which implies that there is a spiritual magnet point in that area. A smattering of Victorian houses on Dwight Way. It's mostly sort of semi-urban until after the earthquake of 1906. The East Bay was not affected, so lots of people who were rendered homeless by the earthquakes moved to Berkeley and set up a bunch of new housing, including here on this block. They cut a new street through it. Haste Street is built after the earthquake, and they built a ton of very cool colonial revival houses. And there is a website called something like Before People's Park, and it's a bunch of photographs of all the Italian colonials, mission revivals, and other houses that were knocked down by the university. And so as we go forward, there's sort of two sides to this story. There's the university and the hippies. And I want it to be made clear that everyone involved is bad. So the university covets this housing. It does decay because it's near the university. And so the houses become subdivided, turn into rooming houses. There's still some very nice houses there. Architecturally, there's gorgeous houses there. The university plans in 1956 to acquire Block 1875 for student housing and parking, but they have to wait until they're given a grant that will cover the costs of doing eminent domain, which is to say getting the city to condemn all that property so that the university can build student housing on it. They bulldoze everyone's houses, and then they run out of their grant money, and it stays a horrible vacant lot for about a year after they've knocked down all the houses and driven out all the people. So in April of 1969, a bunch of activists who are thick on the ground in Berkeley occupy the site and begin to landscape it as a park because it looks hideous. In May of 1969, May 15th, the university fences off the site to begin construction of its dorms, and 4,000 protesters besiege the site, tearing down fences. Berkeley and university cops fire into the crowds with shotguns, using birdshot, but birdshot kills birds, and also it killed at least one person, a guy named James Rector, who wasn't even protesting. He was sort of standing near the protest.
As is often the case, it's just people who are bystanders to protest and get hurt.
Right. And so the official number is 43 hospitalizations. Wikipedia and Berkeley protesters will quote you 128 hospitalizations. So take your choice. Too many hospitalizations. It's known as Bloody Thursday. Governor Reagan sends in the National Guard. They occupy the site and much of the rest of Berkeley for 2 weeks afterward. And then the riot being over, the National Guard leaves and the hippies come back. And so this is what sort of turns it into a martyrdom spot for the counterculture, and they occupy it continuously to prevent the university from trying any more shenanigans. The university tries to put in, for example, a soccer field in 1971. There are gigantic protests over that, and so they can't put in their soccer field. In 1979, the university tries to sneaky-like put in a parking lot, and the protesters tear it up and build a free speech stage where the parking lot was. By 1980s, the park has become a drug market, and I guess the question there is, how can you tell? But even in Berkeley, there are places that are drug markets, and you begin to see the increasing numbers of homeless people who live in the park because people are staying in the park 24/7, so they gravitate to the crowds and the absence of police presence. 1984, People's Park is declared a landmark by the city of Berkeley, which one assumes is thumbing the university in the eye for some reason. In 1991, the university puts in basketball and volleyball courts. The protests are mad at the volleyball courts, which eventually are removed in 1997. Everyone seems pretty chill about the basketball courts. By the 2000s, the homeless presence has become full-on encampments. You get the concomitant rats and filth and whatnot, rising crime and drug concerns. People in the neighborhood are now mad at People's Park. They don't like it anymore. It's not fun and hippie. It's just disgusting. In 2011, there's another attempt to knock down the park by the university. They managed to bulldoze the west end of it, but tree sit protests keep them from chopping down the trees. And one protester falls out of a tree and injures themselves pretty badly. In 2018, the university says, surely people have stopped paying attention. Here's our new plan for People's Park. And everyone says, this looks very much like your 1956 plan. And they say, no, no, there's a little green space right there. And that's where we'll commemorate People's Park, in the tradition of all developers everywhere who name it after the thing you killed in order to build it. The plans are delayed by COVID, but in 2021, they begin fencing off the block. The protesters tear down the fences and dismantle all the construction equipment. 2022, they go back again to try that, and instead of protesters wrecking things, they get a court case that says you didn't file the SEPA, the environmental filing, for the noise that will be caused by student housing, which is quite the statement given what People's Park had been emitting before that. But anyway, that works its way through the courts, but the court, even the stay, says university has an absolute right to fence the park because they do own it. And so the university fences off the whole block in January of 2024 with shipping containers, which a week after that they top with razor wire and then clear out all the homeless people who've been living in the park. That's about 70 people. They chase them all out. In June of 2024, the California Supreme Court hears the case of the stay from 2022. They side with the university because the university has a clear title to the land. Construction begins. They have finished erecting the dorms by the end of last year, and they're on track for student occupation in academic year 2027-2028. And that is the saga, the dispiriting saga of People's Park in Berkeley, California. But again, I said Berkeley at the beginning.
So have you looked at the concept sketches to judge whether this is an attractive piece of architecture in order to make this an architecture hut segment, or is it just sort of standard functional?
Well, I'll say this for it, Robin. It looks better than standard brutalism. There's going to be, it looks like brick or sandstone facing. There is some degree of ornament on the windows, but no, it's three hideous dorm blocks and an administration block. It's not going to remotely look as good as all the Italian mansions, colonial revivals, and Victorians they knocked down back in 1968. It's less hideous than it could be, I guess, which is the best you could say about academic architecture in this year of our Lord 2026. But yeah, that's what I will say about it architecturally. It's better than standard brutalism. Someone put some effort into not offending the eye when you look at it, but it's not going to be an attractive set of buildings.
And I guess I should say that if you live in many big cities, including Toronto, you're familiar with the issue of encampments of the unhoused, where the authorities sort of have a shelter system for people who need housing, but it's terrible and dangerous, so that people would much rather, you know, risk being in an encampment than being in a smaller space with a lot of people who might well knife them. And the desire of taxpayers is for basically, you know, homeless people to evaporate. And, you know, the option of, you know, providing, you know, proper housing is just never seems to be on the table. So it's an unfortunate situation where if people don't have proper housing and they're gathered together, there are safety issues, but no one wants to pay for the what will ultimately be cheaper to look after people. But no, nobody likes that.
Well, leaving California homeless policy for the world of fantasy and imagination, we can say that the block, as I said, it attracted that church in 1874. So there is probably some sort of spiritual magnet spot. There were flying saucers seen over Berkeley in 1955, which is right before the university decided to acquire Block 1875. I don't know that they were seen over that block because these articles do not give, you know, plat designations for where they saw the UFO. But, you know, one can assume that they would also have been over Block 1875. And then in 1975, the UFOs came back, I guess, to check up on it. And then they saw that it was a park and got confused because there doesn't seem to have been any flying saucer sightings over Berkeley since the 70s. I will also point out that 1875, the name of the block, Kabbalistically equates to Attika de Attikin, the ancient of the ancient ones, or the concealed of the concealed. This is a term from the Zohar referring to Kether, the fundamental emanation of God. And to those of us who are not necessarily completely on board with the Zohar mythos, the ancient of the ancient ones does sound kind of creepy and scary. So I leave it to you whether or not the bold congregationalists who put that church there were trying to pen down the ancient of the ancient ones and prevent it from doing bad stuff like Berkeley, or if they were trying to harness the power of Kether, the radiant crown of God. And I guess that's the sort of duality that has been dealing with the park, certainly since 1969 and even now, I suppose.
Right. So it seems like the radiant forces are trying to prevent the university from harnessing them and have drawn people to protect them. And it's the whatever architectural power lies in the shipping containers and the barbed wire, which is going to be, you know, for nearby residents, really a beautiful temporary addition to things, is, you know, the way the university is fighting back. And but who knows what will happen to the students when they occupy that place. So in order to turn this to a funner story, even within the horror genre, I think you either have to go back to 69 and have that a conflict over the park be a background to a Delta Green style situation, or we flash forward to 27, 28, when the students are occupying the building and they've moved into this place where all of this negative energy that's been twisted by conflict and people struggling with each other and the suppressed Kabbalistic forces begin to work on them. And so you have a situation where students are beginning to be affected by it and act in strange ways. And perhaps the solution at the end will be to blow up the housing and return it to, if not its natural state, its state of equilibrium between forces and turn it back into a pile of rubble yet again.
Well, if we're talking about taking academic architecture and turning it into a pile of rubble, as you say, that may be the best solution in a game. But yeah, the notion that the energies of God derange you is not a particularly unique to Lovecraft notion. I think that William James used to talk about the vastation that was when you got too near to the idea of the divine, you would be deranged by it. I think, you know, if that is, you know, the crown of Kether that is somehow present in that stretch of Berkeley, that could explain an awful lot, frankly. As I say, not just the park where people are crazy in Berkeley, that's just where they had a sign for it. The notion that Berkeley is sort of a weirdness hellmouth can fuel any number of sort of reality horror or existential detective type stories. You could probably run a pretty ripping bubblegum shoe game amongst the new students who are moving into this quad, and rather than necessarily blow it up in a paroxysm of excitement like Buffy does at the end of her season arc, you just have to deal with all the weird stuff that is being harnessed through this fundamentally masked architecture from the power of Kether, which is not something so easy as just a mouth of hell. It's a mouth of sort of divine power that can be tapped or altered. And if you don't, it will tap or alter you in ways that are beyond our comprehension, because it's the concealed of the concealed and nobody knows what it's up to.
Well, before we get tapped or altered, it's time for us to head on out to another hut and or site.
The play The King in Yellow has haunted imaginations like a dirge since its first appearance in 1895.
But among the fortune tellers of Europe, the play was not the fearful beginning of something new, but the culmination of something older, The King in Yellow Tarot.
Daniel Harms and John Scott Tynes, famous clairvoyants, divined the form's importance of this Carcosan deck.
Painter Kurt Komoda, in a fevered fugue of inspiration, reproduced designs thought long lost.
Spread the cards.
Let the King in Yellow tell your fate.
There is no other who could.
After all, you have seen the yellow sign.
The King in Yellow Tarot is a complete deck of 78 cards in full color.
Sturdy cards with a soothing, silky finish.
Inspired by the works of Robert W. Chambers.
An accompanying 28-page guide explores the history of the deck and recommends, hesitantly, its technique.
A complete PDF of cards and guide comes with your order.
Add to cart at shop.arcdream.com.
That's your reality-shattered cart at shop.arcdream.com. Keep the real version of this podcast headed your way every week by joining beloved Patreon backers
Jonathan Laufersweiler,
Jay Moore,
Ryan McClelland,
Tone Milazzo,
and Tony Kemp.
The jingly bell hat, the white gown of Columbine, the happy mask and the sad mask on the wall welcome us into not a prop closet, but a stock character hut, because in these huts, we keep the stock characters to inform and infuse your drama. And the stock character hut today is crowded, because inside the stock character hut, we have the Big Lug. Robin, I found the first Big Lug, I think, with St. Christopher.
Right. Well, let's decide what a Big Lug is and see if St. Christopher fits that.
All right.
So the heyday of the Big Lug is in 30s cinema, and his dramatic poles are, he's a hard softy. He's angry on the outside and soft in the middle, and he's big. He's physically prepossessing, although at least one example we'll come to is emotionally big, but not necessarily physically big. And so the thing is the tough softy or the soft toughy. The same actors will often sometimes play palookas or, you know, outright henchmen, but these are the people who are sort of balanced on being kind and admirable, yet they have a temper that may cause trouble. for themselves if they're the protagonist, or for the protagonist if they're supporting characters. So how is St. Christopher a big lug?
St. Christopher, according to the legend of Bartholomew, which I guess tells you about how much St. Christopher matters, he was a giant, and in some versions he's a dog-headed giant, a gnoll, and he goes out from a town. Sometimes it's a town of cannibals, always it's a town of sinners, and he says, I'm too good a warrior for this stupid town. I will only serve the greatest king that ever lived. And guess what? He meets Saint Bartholomew, and Saint Bartholomew says, turns his hat around and sits backwards on the chair and says, let me tell you about the greatest king that ever lived, and it was Jesus. And Saint Christopher is converted and becomes a force for good. And so his adventures are sort of like carrying people across rivers and stopping bad guy invasions of the newly Christian town and overawing the people of the other town that were mean to Saint Bartholomew, which is why he was out in the wilderness dealing with giants. And so he's sort of St. Bartholomew's big henchman in the story of St. Bartholomew. And this goes back to the 5th or 6th century AD. I mean, I guess if you... St. Christopher's been de-canonicized by the church, so I guess we don't have to actually think that there was a giant that wandered around doing miracles in the 1st century AD. But if you want to believe it, who am I to stop you? There are worse things to believe, certainly, possibly in this very segment.
Right. So the big lug as a sidekick to the hero, the bigger, more muscular sidekick, the other possibly even bigger mythic reference would be Little John in the Robin Hood stories. So this does have a provenance. And this is an example of Stock Character Hut referencing not only the dramatic side of the games I create of hill folk and of page turners, but a lot of the things we're going to mention actually are within the action genre world, as you would sort of expect with someone who's big and physically capable. Mm-hmm. We'll be facing some external obstacles. So obviously you need actors of a certain physicality to embody this type. Notable big lugs in classic cinema. You got to start with someone who's one of those actors who's a big, big star at the time and now is essentially completely forgotten, unless you're a really hardcore classic movie buff, and that's Wallace Beery, sort of embodied the sort of rough and tumble guy with a heart of gold. His most famous movie is The Champ, and he's paired with Jackie Cooper, a kid actor in that one. Cooper also appears in The Bowery, and having a kid sidekick to the big lug protagonist brings you that foil thing where the kid emphasizes the softness, although there's a hardness to Jackie Cooper often. And so he's also a hard, soft character in terms of his dramatic pulls. Other titles in which Beery plays big lugs, you can just tell from their titles, The Mighty McGurk or Barnacle Bill. William Bendix comes along just a little bit later. If you know The Glass Key or The Woman of the Year, you may know him from that. He's a classic sort of mug character. He's also in Lifeboat. And so often the big lug in the 30s films has a proletarian aspect to them, as well as possibly a hair-trigger temper or a sense of danger to them. Mike Mazurki, who sometimes is more likely to go kind of to the palooka side of things, the antagonist, appears in Murder, My Sweet, Night in the City. A little later on, Lee Marvin plays a big lug who solves his friendship problems with John Wayne by periodically having a big giant brawl with him. That's in the movie Donovan's Reef by John Ford. And the not literally big lug I mentioned earlier would be Edward G. Robinson in some of his more proletarian roles. For example, The Sea Wolf, where he plays an angry fishing captain and he pulls off the big lug thing, even though Robinson is 5'4", but his personality makes up for his physicality, and you never question the fact that he could mop the deck with any errant crewmen. It's sort of an older trope. We don't quite see it obviously anymore for reasons we'll get to in a bit. For example, you can see it in Archie comics, where the creators of those characters are looking for different archetypes to embody. So there's one of the gang is, his main thing is he's big and like a lot of big lugs, not necessarily the smartest character, but in that case also sort of has a sweet soul. And Ken, you've noticed a Muppet who has a big lug.
Sweetums the Muppet is a classic big lug. He's enormous. He looks terrifying, but of course he's named Sweetums and he is sweet. Even when he's mauling you, it turns out he's probably just trying to hug you and pat you because he's such a good guy. You point up Lurch as a big lug and something that
he's your gothic big lug. Yeah, right? He's big and scary, but he's also nurturing.
And something that I thought would be apropos, and I didn't put it in, but I should have, because as you say, Jaws, Richard Kiel, begins as the terrifying bruiser in The Spy Who Loved Me, and then becomes the amiable big lug with the soft heart in Moonraker, which only one of the many problems with Moonraker, but there we are. Richard right. Kiel embodies that transition, I think, as well as anyone that you're going to see in 70s film, certainly.
Right. But then, here we go. The Terminator does exactly the same thing, also spread out over two movies. So Terminator 1, he's a big bruiser. He's a menacing monster. And Terminator 2, as we call him, he becomes a big lug, and he has those qualities. He's not dumb, but he's has a limited vocabulary. He's both nurturing and ultra-violent. And he is perhaps, you know, the biggest box office big lug that we have in our memory. It is also a staple character in Marvel Comics because, of course, Stan Lee is heavily influenced by 30s movies, and so is Jack Kirby. So The Thing is also a classic big lug. He's a sweet-hearted guy who's literally made of stone, who gets mad and declares clobbering time. The 70s Hulk, the more childlike one who speaks in a primitive manner, is also a big lug. You know, he loves kids and red-tailed deer, but people are always causing trouble for him. And we see that in the Marvel Cinematic Universe with Dave Bautista's version of Drax the Destroyer. He's called the Destroyer, and he talks constantly about crushing people's heads and stuff, but he's also very sensitive and kind and is another quintessential contemporary big lug. I said that this character is sort of going away, but that's a big counterexample to that.
And I think modern cinema viewers probably have already twigged to this, but Andre the Giant is the classic big lug in The Princess Bride. And to a similar extent, Hagrid is a big lug, I think more in the books than he is in the movies, but there he is, good old Hagrid. So the archetype seems to have left realist movies sometime around Moonraker and moved into sort of fantasy and comics and things like that. We don't see an awful lot of big lugs, for example, in Guy Ritchie movies where you would expect there to be a big lug because there's all kinds of different gangster, but none of them are particularly sweet. They're just sort of varying degrees of scary. Vinnie Jones waiting to be cast as a great big lug, but he's only been a bruiser, I think, mostly in films, right?
Yes, I think that's right. Part of this, I think, is that needing a big lug to contrast with the hero in modern movies is less relevant because every actor is jacked to the hilt.
Yeah.
And so the idea that I'm the smarter regular guy and you're the super muscular guy, everybody's super muscular now, so it no longer signifies anything.
Yeah. Tom Cruise does not need Wallace Beery to beat people up for him. He can beat people up.
Exactly. There's the comic version of the big lug, which you can find earlier versions of, but not quite as clearly as in the case of Ralph Cramden from The Honeymooners, played by Jackie Gleason. He is a big, blustery, ineffectual guy who gets angry and threatens his wife, but you never read that, or you're not meant to read that as actually threatening, but as an expression of his actual impotence and softness. And that has, I think, led to the current comedy version of this big lug. It's now kind of morphed into the big guy. So his physicality, he's still large, but the idea of him being hard or dangerous is sort of gone. And you can look at, for example, a lot of John Candy roles. He's the big guy, and often the opposition then becomes his big size contrasted with his vulnerability. John Goodman, who gets cast in many different archetypal roles, will sometimes play a classic big lug. King Ralph, for example, is a not that recent, but relatively recent example of a big lug as a protagonist of a film. Kevin James also slots into that, both in his sitcom King of Queens and then Paul Blart Mall Cop. And like John Goodman, has recently taken a turn for the tougher and more sinister, and so he's playing darker roles. So we haven't fully had him then reverse back into being both at one time, but that'll be an interesting thing to see. So reasons to have a big lug character in your dramatic games are just that they offer a contrast. You can decide to play one as your character, and there you've got your opposition between oscillating between menace and sentimentality, between hard and soft, or he can be a foil character who reflects something about the main character and played by the game master. And of course, this is a type of character that you can choose to play. Like any procedural role-playing game, you can decide to give yourself a big strength rating. You can give yourself a big size rating for games that specify how big you are. And you can play your character as very sweet and nice and kind and nurturing, except when it's clobbering time, in which case you pull out the D20s and roll them just like anybody else would.
Yeah, the other possibility for the big lug, and one of the sort of things that happened in some of these 30s movies, like Murder, My Sweet, is that the big lug is a guy that you would meet in the course of your investigation. Their initial instinct or their initial instructions from the main bad guy are to beat the hell out of you, but you can talk them around because they don't really want to beat the hell out of you. They want to find their missing showgirl girlfriend or whatever. And so you can negotiate with a big lug in a way that you cannot with a bruiser, even if the big lug begins on the other team. And so because the big lug genuinely doesn't want to spend his life beating people up. He wants to, you know, settle down with a cute girl. And so you can share information about the missing showgirl, or you can say, I'll help find the girl if you just don't beat me up, and you get them in on your side. We get a little of that in Ocean's 11, where the guy that Terry Benedict hires to beat up Danny Ocean turns out to be an old buddy of Danny Ocean's. And so I don't know if that's a big lug or a faux lug, but either way, it's the sort of face turn that you can get out of big lug characters, even in, you know, a straight up Trail of Cthulhu style investigation, because human foes, you should have other strategies than shoot them or beat them up. You should be able to talk to them. So putting a big lug into the game as the GM is a way to offer that as an opportunity for players. And if you're a player, try it. Maybe the GM has also seen Wallace Beery movies and can't wait to show the inner Andre the Giant of their outer Andre the Giant big lug.
Right. Finally, I think people will be asking about Reacher. And I think he's, although he rips people apart for an altruistic reason.
Yeah.
I think he's too smart to count as a big lug. He's more of a reverse big bruiser.
Yeah. People on TV Tropes who have no sensibilities will say Superman is a big lug. It's like, no, Superman is Superman. Reacher is just enormous Batman. He's Batman drawn by Frank Miller, not Batman drawn by, you know, Jim Aparo. That's all that is.
Yes. Possibly Bizarro is a big lug.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, let us go protected by our faithful big lug to our final segment of this episode. The British are coming!
To the American South and the lands over the mountains in Flag Bearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated, in Nations and Cannons you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
Ken and Robin listeners can download a free PDF copy of the core rules from nationsandcannons.com using code KenRobin.
And educators can get a physical copy for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The next book, The American Crisis, Dark and Bloody Ground, follows the actions of the war in the South and the West, with historical adventures, setting information, perfidious new enemies, and a sprawling campaign.
Salvage the rebels' foreign alliances in Haiti and Spanish New Orleans.
Recover a mysterious map from Daniel Boone.
Sail into the heart of darkness, investigating George Rogers Clark's strange conquest of Vincennes.
Escape when all seems lost at Savannah and Charleston.
Fight the guerrilla war alongside the Swamp Fox in a fast-moving hex crawl.
And save the revolution at the climax at York. Town.
Sign up to be notified of the Kickstarter campaign at yourdadwilllovethis.com. It's time once more to wend our way up the creepity cobweb stairs. We're going to pause on the landing to wave at the portrait of the fire salamander, one of our favorite elementals. He's going to wave back because he's magical. And then we're going to head on into the parlor of the consulting occultist, who this time around is going to pick up a thread that we dangled a few episodes back when Ken, you had a book referencing the other geomancy, the one with the sand and the dots, Arabic geomancy. And by other geomancy, we mean, of course, one of four possible geomancies.
Yeah. The trouble with geomancy is no one bothered to pick correct names for anything. So classical geomancy is divination by earthquakes, Mudus noises, and volcanism. And this is done by the Etruscans, famously, by the Greeks. Dioscurus mentions it. There's lots of cases of, you know, that hill made a weird noise, therefore the gods are mad, therefore we figure out what's going on. That's classical geomancy. Then when they discovered feng shui, they meaning Europe, they didn't know how to translate feng shui, so they translated it geomantia, and feng shui is mapping the energy flows through the earth and manipulating them with built structures and with gardens and with, you know, living correctly. And that's feng shui. Then that version of geomancy took root in the new age, and so we had to make up things about ley lines and pyramids and vortexes. And that's not feng shui, first of all, because it's straight lines, not curves, but it also has a sort of a different consonance. So it's a new kind of geomancy. And finally, there is the one with the sand and the dots, which is called Arabic geomancy by people who are trying to sort things out. So that's the Wikipedia article you want, or geomantic figures, which is the article that maybe should have been in Arabic geomancy, but there's a link, so I'm not too beat up about it. The books you want are the book that we alluded to during that bookshelf, John Michael Greer's The Art and Practice of Geomancy, or the OG book in English, Stephen Skinner's Terrestrial Astrology, Divination by Geomancy. That's 1980, and that is a very good text for the history and the ways of geomancy. But Arabic geomancy began, perhaps unsurprisingly, in Arab countries. It was called Kat al-Ramal, meaning cutting the sand, or Ilm al-Ramal, the science of sand, the knowledge of sand. And they said, oh, the prophet Idris learned geomancy from the angel Gabriel. He was sitting around, he was bored, he was drawing little designs in the dirt with a stick, and a man came up to him and said, what's that design? And Idris said, I just drew it. And the man said, you're wrong. And he told him what the design was. And Idris said, well, I'll draw another design. And the guy told him another thing about it. And so 16 designs later, he said, by the way, I'm the angel Gabriel. And Idris said, yeah, I'm a prophet. I figured that out about design three. But in some versions, Idris then had to go to India to learn it. But that may be a conflation, because Hindi may also mean geomancer in Arabic. So it's probably not India.
Right. And also there's a desire to say that this is an acceptable form of magic within Islam. So there's a tradition that Muhammad approved of it, Muhammad the prophet. But of course, if he'd approved of it, he would have written it down. That was the whole point. Write down everything you approve of. So that is not, in fact, on the record.
No, and Ibn Khaldun, in fact, very famously said, yeah, people are practicing geomancy all over the place. I don't hold with it because it's not in the Quran. So that was his beef with geomancy. But as Ibn Khaldun noted, it is big in North Africa. It's practiced in North Africa and Egypt by the 8th century AD. Muslim traders and slavers, but flip sides, spread geomancy to the Dahomey, where it becomes Fa, Yoruba, where it becomes Ifa. And rather than sand and dots, they use cowrie shells and nuts to derive the figures. In Madagascar, it's called Sikidi, and it's very similar to Arabic geomancy. In Byzantium, their near neighbors, it became Rampleon or Rebolion. And eventually, by the 12th century, it gets to those slackers in Western Europe, and they call it geomantia. And that is the key figures there. As I say, it's the 12th century. So you start with Hugh of Santalla, who is in Aragon and doing his geomancy work around 1125. Plato of Tivoli, who's in Barcelona doing work of geomancy around 1140. Gerard of Cremona, he's a big name. He's in Toledo, center of learning in Spain. And around 1160, he translates a number of Arabic poems on geomancy. And Bernardus Silvestris, who we don't even know where he was. People say, I don't know, Chart, but they're thinking of a different Bernard, so it could have been anywhere. But by 1165, he's writing poems in Latin about geomancy. So it becomes big. Bartholomew of Parma writes an enormous Summa of Geomancy in 1288. And Peter of Abano, he was famous for writing a different magic book and eventually got in bad trouble for the Inquisition for writing magic books, wrote a big treatise on it around 1310. Chaucer and Dante both refer to it. Chaucer, in a sort of a skeptical vein, says, yeah, you'll believe geomancy next. And Dante, when they're looking up, they see, much like the rising dragon, going along the way. And those are two geomantic figures. And so Dante knows his stuff and knows that it is so common that he can just allude to them and no one needs it explained. In the fourth book of occult philosophy, whoever was signing his name Agrippa, who may or may not have been Agrippa, summarizes a Renaissance geomancer named Cocles and Bartholomew of Parma, along with Gerard of Cremona and Hali, a Arabic astrologer, maybe, or actually one of six or seven Arabic astrologers. We don't know which one, but Agrippa says that he did geomancy. And this is where we begin to see, and some of this is in Gerard of Cremona as well, that geomancy and astrology.
Right. And Hali might have been a black lake. We don't know.
Right. Could have been in a black lake. Who can say? But geomancy and astrology are teamed up. And the reason it's teamed up, first of all, is, if all you have is astrology, everything looks like a zodiac. But also, astrology is generally considered to be natural magic. God put the stars there. You're just reading them. And so if you can say geomancy is astrology, but just on the ground and with dots, then you can maybe get away from the Inquisition on it. That doesn't always work. C.F. Peter of Bobano. Another great geomantist, Christopher Catan. No relation to the Saturday Night Live character, unless around 1558, he posthumously published a book on geomancy. So it was not the guarantee that it might be. But that book was owned by Simon Forman, who we remember from episode 695, and by Robert Flood, who does his own geomantic studies around 1600 while he's in Avignon. And that's episode 591. We talk about Robert Flood. And so then a guy named John Hayden, between 1662 and 1664, writes a three-volume text called Theomagia, which is divine magic. You can't argue with that. Temple of Magic. And it's about geomancy, and it is so boring that it kills the whole field off, basically. We're into the early modern.
It's much better than the Inquisition. You just hire a really boring dude to write a very dull book, and that'll take care of magic for you.
Because after that, everyone says, well, John Hayden kind of wrote everything about geomancy. I don't have to mention it. Just go read Hayden. And nobody really takes it up in the early modern era because it becomes clear that the connection to astrology is sort of tenuous. It becomes kind of a dumbed down pastime. Popular astrologers will allude to it, but it basically becomes folk magic rather than scientific magic or proper divination. And Mathers, MacGregor Mathers, in The Golden Dawn, takes those 800 pages of Hayden and compresses them down to a 24-page knowledge lecture on geomancy, which is where most modern geomancy comes from, is those 24 pages that Mathers did, including...
They're right down to TED Talk length.
Right. The theosophist Franz Hartmann, a German theosophist and fan of the Armanen and the Volkisch movement and Guido von Liszt and all that bad stuff. But he writes a text on geomancy in 1913. So it's still a thing in the occult revival, but it never really catches on.
Right. And it continues to live on outside Europe and also filters down sort of into a more commonplace popular magic. So, for example, people who practice traditional medicine in Tanzania will use the tables from Arabic geomancy as part of the things that they consult when they're determining what people have and how to heal them.
And the divination by cowrie shells and nuts that they use in the Yoruba, in Ifa, obviously flows with the slave trade into voodoo and candomblé. And so there are plenty of geomantic practices in the African diaspora in the Western Hemisphere. And that continues to be a thing, but that is a little ways away from the sort of the mainstream that we're talking about. So there's only 16 of these figures. They're associated with the signs of the zodiac. Sometimes you say, but there's 12 signs of the zodiac. Some of the zodiacs double up. They're associated with planets. Once Agrippa gets his hands on things, they start having, you know, flavors and smells and stones and angels and all manner of other stuff. So they're very similar to tarot figures. And we could list the 16 or you could go look it up. I mentioned the way, for example, that's just four dots in a line. All the figures are built of either two dots or one dot. So they're kind of like the hexagrams from the I Ching, where you have a broken line or a straight line. With this, you have two dots or one dot, and they're four tall. So either you have eight dots, like, you know, the eight of spades, or you have some differentiation of one and two dots. And the way that you get your geomantic figures to do the casting is you stab some random dots into the sand on 16 lines. You don't think about it at all. And as far back as the Arabs, this is meant to be, you're listening to the earth. You're letting the earth flow through you. It's kind of like dowsing. You're not supposed to control your stick. You're just supposed to bap, 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 bap. You do that 16 times. Then you count the dots on each of your lines. If it's an odd number of dots, that's one dot. If it's an even number of dots, that's two dots. And that maps your quadrogram. So those are the four binary figures, one or two dots on four lines. Those are called the mother figures. You take the first line from each mother and stack them, and that becomes the first daughter. Second line of each mother, stack them. Second daughter, go on. That's four daughters. So those are all in a row, mothers and daughters. And then you add the dots in the neighboring figures. And so if you have an odd number of dots, that's one dot. Even number of dots, that's two dots. That creates four nieces, and that you can stop there and then map them onto a standard astrological chart. And so you have a sign inside a sign, and that interplay will tell you stuff. If a given figure shows up a lot, that's clearly what's going on. Then you can read them as an astrological chart, or you can continue to make the full 16, add the dots and the two pairs of nieces to make the witnesses, add the two witnesses to make the judge. And then sometimes you add the judge and the first mother to make a reconciler. And then that goes into what's called a geomantic shield, which is a full-on geomantic chart. And that is basically what you do. And then there is as much, actually, there's probably more ways to read a geomantic shield than there are an astrological chart, because it is interpretive in the way that a tarot spread is interpretive. So if you think of it as a 16-card tarot deck, that you can have specific positions that mean things, but you can't do upside down and reversed, then that's basically what geomancy looks like at the table.
Right. And people who know the I Ching will also be thinking, oh, wait, this is another system that uses odds and evens, combines them into lines, combines the lines into more sophisticated patterns in order to come up with a set of ideas and symbols that you then add a layer of interpretation to. I find a really cool thing, poking around a bit, which the British Museum has an apparently one-of-a-kind item, which is a 13th century copper tablet made in Damascus, which is essentially a Arabic geomancy machine where you turn dials in order to get the figures. And the people who have studied it aren't entirely sure how the whole deal works, because it does seem to bring a shield in, but it's not clear how that is. If you flip it over, you can see all the gears that operate this. It's not on display. So, you know, we can get all Dan Brown about that, about being, you know, hidden from the public, except there are very beautiful, clear pictures of it that you can find and use as a prop to drop in the Slack channel for your players, both front and back. So search the British Museum site for divination equipment, and that will come up, and you can have a fun time puzzling out exactly how this complicated apparatus was used as a even more complex technological form of this divination.
Yeah, you could in theory have, you know, like in the same way that your game might have a living embodiment of a tarot card or a living embodiment of a zodiac sign going around causing trouble, you might have a living embodiment of a geomantic figure. So you really have to worry about the head of the dragon or carcere, the prison. That's if your dots make a little circle. Amissio is Latin for loss, but it does not make the loss meme. It's just, you know, a little two bowls or cups upside down is what they interpreted at. Head of the dragon, that's always good. Conjunction, that doesn't make an X. The Rubio is bad, so that's the red. So I'm sure vampires are down with this stuff. It's the inversion, because it looks like an upside down wine glass. And Albus is the white, that's the good one. That's the upright glass, but it's a situation. And the eight of spades that I mentioned, that is populace. That's everybody. That's all the people. So go to the geomantic figures Wikipedia or look in either of those books. That'll give you lots of jumping off points for weird powers and strange shapes. And as with any sort of a grid thing, much like in the I Ching, you know, you can spot them in the other kind of geomancy. Like you notice that some lights are on and off in buildings, and those are making geomantic figures, or that they're constructing a building but not constructing another building. So you have odds and evens on a city block. And all of that sort of mapping can provide occult meaning to your cityscape. And that, of course, as I mentioned, ties into either feng shui type geomancy or a ley line type geomancy, because now you've got buildings in it into the mix, and that's Clark Ashton Smith territory.
Right. So it seems like the most fun thing to do with this is to have your character who has the power of prophecy. This is a different style of prophecy that, you know, you've done the tarot a bunch of times, you've done the I Ching, you've made up one that didn't work so well. So this lesser known but still fascinating one with a long history is something that you could adopt and find a lot of flavor in. And having found the gaming flavor, it's time for us to head on out. But next week, we don't have a regular episode, because this episode, $6.99, it's just a regular episode, no big deal. But next week, Ken, you know what happens in episode 700? Why, it's the
Lightning Round!
See you next week, folks. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrain Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dark Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/canonrobin.
Help us out, you big palookas, alongside such backers as
Alex Johnston,
David Mascari,
Kevin J. Maroney,
Alan McSager,
and Jeff Cars.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindelaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.